We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, Episode 73. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we talk to Rauno Lohokangas about rock art in Northern Europe and how we interpret the past to inform the present.
Let's dig a little deeper. Today we're interviewing Rauno Lohokangas, a high-energy physicist, which you never would think we'd interview on this show, but he has an interest in prehistoric rock art of Northern Europe, and he lives in Finland, and he works in Estonia, or works with rock art societies in Estonia, and actually helped in 1998 found the Finnish Society for Prehistoric Art. So he's a pretty fascinating guy and has a lot of interests that intersect with this show and our audience and what they want to talk about. So let's get to the interview and find out more about this fascinating man. All right. Welcome to the show, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast, April. I feel like because I'm doing the radio show that, you know, I'm kind of doing the show with and without you and everybody's confused.
That's all right. I'm not too offended.
Sounds good. All right. Well, as I mentioned in the introduction, we have a fascinating guest on today, Rauno Lohokangas. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this interview.
Yeah, no problem. So why don't we get started here and just tell our listeners, you know, what's your background related to archaeology and rock art? Like what got you into all this?
Well, starting from my childhood, I was very fascinated about rock paintings. When I was reading such small books. And then later, actually, I have been interested in rock art all my life. Mm-hmm. Even my profession is, I'm a high-energy physicist, my education. And yeah. But physics is also like archaeology. Anyway, so I have been fighting for the actually preserving rock painting and rock carvings in Finland. In a way that I'm one of the founding father of the Finnish Society for Prehistoric Art, mm-hmm. which we established in 1998. So we are now more than 20 years old society. And we collaborate very often with the Estonian friendship, similar kind of society. And actually, 1 week ago, I was there in Estonia, where we have a small gallery. Mm-hmm. Which is open usually summer times, and I was constructing a next exhibition for this summertime.
Yeah.
So we have had all together something like maybe 15 different kind of expos in that gallery during the last years. So this is the most active part which I've been working now.
Okay.
But I'm also working very often with the Russian colleagues in Russian Karelia, which is east from Finland. And in Russian Karelia, they have two or three magnificent sites of rock carvings, mm-hmm. and which were discovered already, let's say, 150, 170 years ago, actually, one of them. So, because our, let's say, oral tradition is also related with rock paintings and rock carvings, in a way that in my mind or some other people's mind, the rock art is the stone Kalevala, which Kalevala is our oral tradition. So we mm-hmm. can even postulate that we can have some kind of glimpses on this unwritten literature in the carved in the rock, but that's almost a science fiction or paleo fiction, I would say.
Paleo fiction. Okay. I like it. Well, let's back up just for a second here. How, in your mind, I think I have my answer to this, but how in your mind is rock art, is archaeology like physics and physics like archaeology? I love physics. In fact, I just bought a book that's called The Daily Physics Devotional, which is like a quote from a physicist or something like that every day of the year, which I think is fantastic. But how do you see rock art, the intersection of rock art and physics or archaeology and physics?
We can utilize the latest method which has been developed, for example, in high energy physics. I mean to to make documentation of the rock paintings, rock art, more using the latest knowledge we have. But I must say also that every generation will interpret the rock art based on their present culture. So that I have been also recording the different kind of interpretation of the rock art throughout, let's say, 100 or 300 years. So that this time we are, let's say, more fascinating to utilize the science, I mean very strict science, to start trying to understand the aging of the rock art, how they are eroded, and how they can be dated, whatever, and this kind of, and also the demolition of the people, people which destroy the rock art sites. That's the most problematic things actually today in all countries, in every place. So these are the things which are most critical in my mind when I'm working in this area.
I'm curious if you've had an interest in rock art from all the way back when you were a small child. What got you into physics versus, say, going into archaeology? I mean, probably the pay, for one. Archaeology doesn't pay very well. But what's got you, what caused you to go down the physics path instead of the archaeology path?
Well, I was very fascinated on the natural sciences. And my first aim when I went to university was to study chemistry. But I never started to study chemistry because university was a new universe to me. So I selected different kind of subjects, starting from philosophy to mathematics, computer science, and astronomy and whatever. And finally, because I have also earned my money, so I was focusing on more physics and computer science, and I was making my career usually mostly at CERN in Geneva.
Nice.
And but during my free time, I was devoting to archaeology and especially for rock paintings and rock carvings.
What caused you, or what led to the development of the Finnish Society for Prehistoric Art? Was there nothing like that in that area before? I mean, just a whole bunch of people gathered together and decided to formalize and make this thing?
Yeah, there was first trial was something like 1986, when the professors of university, Helsinki University and other city university, they created a small faculty which was focusing on the rock art. But it doesn't get the interest of wide people, I mean the audience. So that the next effort was 1990, and actually I organized in Rasinkarelia Petrosavodsk an international conference to celebrate 150th anniversary of the discovery of the Lake Onega rock art 1848. And during that conference, we, the Finnish people, sat down and we decided that, okay, now it's time to establish the rock art society in Finland, and then the 20 person make a sign, and then we make an official reporting to the registration, the society in the Finnish bureaucratic organization usually. And then we start to work on that part, let's say that more coherent way, not sporadic like before. It was more sporadic before. But then we realized that we can do something else. We can organize conferences, seminars, lectures, organize travels to Scandinavia, in Europe, even in Africa, and also to Soviet Union period, and also to, let's say, very far to Siberia, because in Siberia there are a lot of rock paintings, I mean the cave paintings. There are caves in Siberia where you can find mammoths and different kind of animals, like in cave paintings in France and España. So this is, let's say, the wide topic. So we have different kind of connection all the time in Scandinavia, especially in Scandinavia, and also in Russia. Russia, because in Russia they have a very huge project to trying to get the Karelian rock art under UNESCO World Heritage. And that is a very, very difficult project, because usually if you are somebody would like to have a UNESCO umbrella, it means the 10 years project, because to fulfill all the constraints of UNESCO, they demand, one must do a really good background work. And usually it will take 2-3 time efforts, because after that, an application could be finally approved. But now in Russia, we are in the status that the project is now under the hand of the Russian bureaucrats, I mean the cultural bureaucrats. Mm-hmm. So now it's not anymore in the hand of scientists and enthusiasts. Now it's under hand of bureaucrats, and now it's going on. Because Russia is so fast country, and they have much of intellectual power, that when they understand that something is very important and interesting, they are going to put it forward.
So do most people in Estonia and Finland, do they know about the rock art? Are they familiar with it and recognize it? Or is this something that has sort of existed, but people don't necessarily know about?
Well, I think most of the Finnish people know, because usually rock paintings are still discovered in Finland. For example, last autumn, a small hand figure of a hand and a small figure of moose and a boat was discovered. And this kind of news goes to media, so newspapers and even TV and radio are broadcasting that, okay, once more, a new rock painting has been discovered. In Finland, we have something like 127 sites of the markings made of red ochre. In Finland, we have only rock paintings, but not rock carvings. So this is the background of the Finnish rock paintings. And the first, okay, let's go back to history. Because the first rock painting was discovered, now you must be listen very carefully, was discovered by Jean Sibelius, who was the composer of the Finland. And it was 1911. And that was the starting point. But then the next, let's say, the next boom was in 50s and 60s and 70s. And then gradually we have been starting the very careful studies based on the maps, where we can find the, let's say, the vertical rock hills. Because usually rock paintings are in the vertical rock hills in the strand of the lake. So that is the very good sign to start to find it. And also based on the names, that usually the rock paintings are in the sites where they have names, and sometimes we don't even know what the name means anymore, because the names were named by the people who were living there, let's say 5,000, 7,000 years ago. But even the people disappear, the name stays. And then we can, that's a good hint. I could nominate even maybe 10, 15 different kind of words to match, to try to match on the map. Okay, let's go there. So this kind of thing is like the name of the Eagle Hill, or the Saint Hill, or the hill where you can have a lot of noises, because pagan make noises, this kind of things. So it's easy to find it like this.
That's really cool.
Yeah, that's fascinating that the names remain on the map so well, and that you can kind of trace this ancient history on the modern landscape that way.
Yes, it's a very good sign that usually they have like a Värikallio. There's a most fascinating site in Finland is the middle of the Finland, let's say from Helsinki, 600 kilometers north. There is a hill which is called Värikallio, and I translate it now the color hill. So it gives immediately that there's something colorized in this hill. It's a red ochre, several human figures and hand and boats. And also in our oral tradition in Kalevala, where the hero called Väinämöinen, and there's some verses that this hero on first time I said it in Finnish. Piirsi kirjaili kirjaili kivehen. He was colorized the rock. So it means that even in our Trolla tradition carries information that something has done in very long time in the past. So these are quite fascinating thing to discover.
How old is the oral tradition?
Well, oral tradition, it was collected by Elias Lönnrot. And actually, Hiawatha, which was put together Longfellow in United States, he was fascinating of the Kalevala style to our oral tradition. Because in Finland, we have collection of the, let's say, the raw material of rhymes where people were singing together, and Kalevala is just a very, very tiny compendium of these rhymes. Even it's maybe 500 pages. So that when one read the this kind of oral tradition data in a certain viewing angle, one can make a, let's say, hypothesis that, okay, maybe this is sometime linking to this or that. Even we don't have any more, just we have this raw data available. And it's a huge amount of rhymes. And the collection, the scientists started the work something like 1850s. And the volume number 15 was published 1998. And still, it's same amount of raw data available to make another set of 15 volumes. The volume number 14 was published 1948. So it took 50 years to make the volume number 15, but work is still continuing.
Nice. I step back just a second here. Something you mentioned in Finland, there's no... it's all rock paintings, or what we call pictographs over here, and no rock carvings. Is that
right?
Why do archaeologists think that might be? Is it the type of rock? Is it technology? They just didn't know about it or decide to do it? That seems very odd to me.
Well, I think it's a different culture which was here, but we also said that maybe we haven't not found them yet.
Yeah, there you go.
But also in Sweden, there are rock paintings and not rock carvings. But even in the Göteborg area, there are rock carvings, but they are coming from Bronze Age. So they are younger. Rock carvings are anyway in the high north in Norway, where there's ice sea, then that on that coastal era. They are rock carvings. But in Finland, it's made of red ochre. Always red ochre, and even not using the coal. The coal. So that, and the thing they are preserved is that when the painting is made in the vertical rock, the rock, when there's raining, the rain is consuming the special geological material and conserve the rock paintings, because the rock paintings are then under the transparent calcite. That's why they are preserved.
Wow.
So that then must, like in Canada, they have also rock paintings. And the similar thing is but it's what is most fascinating in Canada, that they have also, the majority of the pictures are boats and moose, and in the big animal. And also in Finland, there's a boat and the moose. So we can say that, okay, they are, if you just see the picture, you can mix them. Okay, maybe this is Canada and this is Finland. So this is quite fascinating in that, let's say, latitude level, the similar kind of material are being used to make rock paintings.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay, well, we are going to take our first break, and then when we come back, we'll continue this discussion about rock art. Thank you. Back in a second. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. All right, welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 73. And we are talking about rock art in Finland and the surrounding area and beyond with Rauno Lohikangas. So to start off this segment, let's talk about what rock art can tell us about the present. I mean, as an archaeologist, we always learn from the past. We try to learn from the past so we can maybe understand the present, understand our future, understand what, you know, mistakes were made, what good things happened, and then maybe learn from that. So in your experience in studying rock art all over that region, what is the message that rock art could tell us about, you know, who we are today?
Yes, we can try to, for example, to find who we are, as you said. And usually there's not so many explanations that sometimes archaeologists say that these figures are related with the hunting, when you can find that there are moose are hunted by spear or an arrow, bows and arrow, and also the hunting of the sea animals like dolphins and seals. But there are also something which is not closely related with this kind of, let's say, materialistic interpretation of the figures. And especially we are now focusing in the Rasen Karelia on the figures which we called where the two animals are in the same figure. I mean that, for example, the leg of the deer, wild deer, is at the same time the neck of the swan. In such a way that when the leg is at the same time the neck of the swan, the leg is figured in incorrect way. So it's not in a natural. If the wild deer is just this only figure, then it's like a natural. Then we have also these kind of figures where the moose and a swan are in opposite. So they are looking each others. Then we have figures where the two swans are looking to each other. So that sometimes we can even say that these are like markings. They are not anymore figures, that they maybe represent something where the two, as I like to say, that nice. Two tribes have come together. And we can follow that how the transformation, for example, that the two swans are in opposite direction, that finally these swans are very difficult to interpret anymore as swans. It's just like a mark. So these kind of things. And also we can find this kind of pattern that when a human is hunting a wild deer, this kind of figure is old when the deer is very big and the human is very small. But when the human is bigger than the moose or the wild deer, then the figure is younger. This means that the human has become a master of a universe. So he has he's now controlling the nature. So this theory was developed by academician Abraham Stolyarin during Soviet Union time. So These are very interesting to understand that can we grasp more about the human behavior based on only these paintings and carvings we have in the wild nature. So these are the, let's say, the most topic thing at the time in Finland and Estonia we are now studying.
Wow, that's really fascinating. I've seen a bunch of rock art over here in the United States, and we see figures that are, you know, carved or drawn on top of other figures, which has its own symbolism. But I don't think I can remember seeing one that, you know, a different time period figure that incorporated the other figures that were around it. That's really, really fascinating. Is that common throughout that area, or is that a thing common to Finland, or how common is that in the rock art that you've seen?
Well, let's say this way, that in Finland, on this area 5,000, 7,000 years ago, we have had maybe 7 clans. And each clan had a totemic animal or spiritual animal. So we have had a clan of bear, the clan of moose, the clan of swan, the clan of raven, the clan of white whale in this in the sea, White Sea area, and other seabirds. So because, for example, in our oral tradition also carries the information about this kind of clan system. It is written there. And when the Roman historian Tacitus written his, let's say, textual book about the north countries, he mentioned that in this north area there's 2 clans whose totemic animal is a bear and the other has a moose. But 2 totemic animals is too less. There must be more. For example, in Chukchi people in Kamchatka in Siberia, I have asked my friend who is Chukchi that which kind of totemic animal he has in his area, and he nominated, for example, the polar bear, raven, bulrush, and some seabirds. And maybe if the stellar sea lion would be still, sea cow would still be available, I postulate that this was also the totemic animal. So now comes the most important thing. Why we had this kind of totemic system? The reason is that when I get my woman, I always took the woman from other tribe and not my tribe. So this was the way to mix genes in let's say systematically. So if I took my woman, my lady from the same tribe, I wouldn't be here to tell my story to you, Chris, right? Because the genes must be mixed in systematic way. And when you know that your own totemic animal, then you know where to go. And I checked once my hypothesis from my student who came from Black Africa. They're very black people, black person. And I asked which kind of totemic animal they have, and they nominated me like buffalo, crocodile, white, snake, fire, antelope. And then I make the most serious question. I ask, could you take your lady from the same buffalo clan as you are? And the answer was absolutely no. And then snake went to my head, and I asked, can you take your lady from your clan if the lady is living, let's say, 5,000 kilometers far away? The answer was also still no. And the answer was so heavy that at the same time, this friend raised his hand to stop this. So this I confirmed that the clan system was needed for that person, like in, let's say, Aboriginal tribes in North America and also in Australia. So this was made to keep the track where you are and where you are going. The same thing is still can you also be verified in chimpanzee, in chimps. When the young chimps is sensing the tribe, this kind of similar behavior can be observed also there.
This is sort of a side question, but it relates to this. So, I mean, when we as archaeologists think about cultures and we as people think about cultures, we often create sort of arbitrary lines based on current, you know, geopolitical boundaries.
Yeah.
For the groups and people who are making this rock art, do you have a sense of what kind of the cultural extent was? I mean, obviously it goes into parts of Russia and Estonia and Finland. Yeah. So is there an idea of how big?
Yes, we can find some, let's say, differences, for example, when the human figure is carved or painted, that for example, usually in Finland, the stickmans are like, they have the round head, but in the north area of Finland, the top head is flat. So the head is like a triangle. And a similar figure we can find out in Kola Peninsula, which is very high north. So the distance from these two sites is 400 kilometers. So we can, let's say, make a hypothesis that there must be have some kind of relationship between these two areas. But for example, if I now put into my mind the two most important sites in Russian Karelia, it's Lake Onega and the river Vyk, which flows to the White Sea. There's two different kind of cultures. The White Sea culture is more hunting related, but the Lake Onega is not. They are not so. There's maybe none hunting images at all in the Lake Onega figures. Even they are almost the same time. And also concerning the Lake Onega figures, there's one island in the center of this lake. The lake is very huge. It's like almost like ocean. On that island there is a cemetery where the very long tall man was buried. The man was almost 2 meters high. And this man has been worshipped more than 2,000 years in this area. And this is based on the information that the man has on his chest a carved figure of the wild deer, made of the bone of the deer. And on the rock carvings in this coastal area of this lake, this similar figure is carved on a rock in such a way that it is pointing to this island. And it is pointing, let's say, in the degree, something like 20, 30 centigrade or degree in the right direction. Mm. And quite a fantastic thing is that the youngest, this kind of figure which has been discovered, the moose head is on the, let's say, the left side when the figure was on the chest of the man, because the figure was pointing to right. So let's say that the last figure the people didn't anymore remember in which side the head was it left or right, left or right. So they did it in the wrong direction. But this dating is based on the radiocarbon detection, which was make an excavation nearby this rock carving area. So this is the way we can connect this, let's say, the timing on these petroglyphs.
Wow.
And the bone of this man is now in the Kunstkamera in St. Petersburg. It was discovered in 1936. Hmm.
That's pretty cool.
When the island was a gulag island during the Soviet Union time, and the prisoners were not making examination, they were carving the chalk. And then they finally discovered that this was a cemetery. And then the scientists came there. It was the most largest cemetery of Mesolithian time. There's more than 400, 500 graves. Hmm. And it's still under research. So, yeah. So these kind of lines we can maybe track or construct.
So, yeah. So these rock art are really telling us about so much more than just, you know, people's interaction with animals. That's really telling us about potential social organization. Are there also evidence of sort of people's maybe religious or spiritual beliefs in connection with these animals and the depictions?
Yeah, there are a lot of, let's say, the sexual pictures also that I think it's related that when people understand that somehow we must also, let's say, preserve the nature, trying to nature be to manifest more animal to be hunted. I mean that. And that's why there are a lot of this kind of copulation pictures with the man and lady are making the child. And also there is two or three figures where the lady is giving a birth, so that the lady's womb is seen. And even in that kind of fine details, that the baby is also carved in the womb of the lady. And this figure is in the lake in the Kola Peninsula, and when I saw this figure, I was there personally. I was really fascinated because I was once involved in the water birth project of the ladies in Finland, and then I started to figure out: is it possible that this also means that this lady was giving the birth in the water? So and on this figure, there's a lady is giving a birth, and his man is just beside him, and the man's penis is almost 3 meters long, and it is going like the snake into the water, and also there's a carvet on the footprint of the man. So they are coming to this site, and it's like a selfie in rock. Hmm. Those two human beings are watching to you when you are standing opposite of them, right. And it's almost vertical. It's almost vertical rock that they are looking at you when you go there, and it's something like 80 centimeter height. Mm-hmm. So this kind of, let's say, also the physical figures can be found in Kola Peninsula, and so on a river Vyg. There's two such kind of giving birth figures. So I mean that at the same time when the people are making babies, they hope that the nature is making babies for them. Mm-hmm. And this is also, we can find out the same tradition in our Finnish oral tradition, which is also recorded now in the textual form by Mikael Agricola, who was developed my mother language, which I'm usually talking. So he has recorded this kind of thing, which was utilized in, let's say, 1500. Yeah. He was living in 1520. He was actually a student of Martin Luther. So So that we can all relate these kind of things in our textual history, and also in trying to match to the petroglyph for the rock paintings.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that is a good point to take our last break, and then we will come back and talk about some really crazy stuff in the last segment here, and where you're going from here. So back in just a minute with the Archaeology Show. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. All right, welcome back to the Archaeology Show, and we are still speaking to Rauno Lauhakangas about rock art. And, you know, in some of the research that we've done about what you're doing, and the person who connected us together, she mentioned this as well. What is the connection in this area between rock art and whales? Because I'll tell you what, living in Nevada here, we don't see a lot of whales in the rock art, so I'm not used to seeing that. There may have been whales here before, but that was probably 20 million years ago, but not whales now. So what is the connection up there with whaling industry and whales and rock art?
Well, yeah, I have studied also whales mm-hmm. during my childhood. I was fascinating on the dolphin brain structure and John Lilly's research. And then it was quite a long story, because I was in 1990 watching the cachalot in Norwegian Sea. And when we came back to Finland, my son, who was then at 8 years old, he told me that the daddy saved the whales. And he was following my discussion with the German scientist in the whale-watching vessel we were in the Norwegian Sea. And he told me how the saving will be done. And he said that we must have so much tourist in this Norwegian area that people get more money out of tourist pocket than just whale hunting. Hmm. And I said, that's a great idea. So I'm just an executive on my son. Then I started to establish whale watching companies all over the world. I have established the companies in Portugal, España, Russia, Iceland, Russia, yes, Russia, and also working as expert in Caribbean Sea and a little bit in Japan even. Mm-hmm. And I have seen also this petroglyph where white whale is carved on the rock in the White Sea areas. And I also read my oral tradition that one of our hero in our oral tradition is a hero, Lemminkäinen, whose spiritual animal is a whale. He was a thug man, you know this. He was like a hooligan. He went to the river of the death and he shot the swan, the black swan of the river. And the man was put into the river as a dead. His mother was looking where his son is and finally get an information that he is on the bottom of the river. And I skip a little bit because it's a long story. But the raven came there and the raven said that the white fish has eaten his shoulders. The pike has eaten his eye. Put the man back to the sea, to the river. Maybe he will become a white fish or as strong as a whale. So it means that the totemic animal of this hero was a whale. Hmm. And that means also that the man will go to the eternal circulation of the living, coming back to his totemic animal to be birthed again. But anyway, the matter didn't give up, and finally he was put the man together. He was knitting together the bones and the muscles, and then finally this hooligan was alive again. So this is the way how it goes on. So this is the way the thing was. That was my aim, to start the whale watching in Russia, and it took me more than 15 years because it was really a very tough task. Yeah. For example, in Spain it took me only 6 months, and in Portugal, in Azores, I was in Azores, it took me, let's say, 1 month to get it running. Because I was using this tourism in a way that the capitalism is the most powerful vehicle human being has ever invented. It's like a demiurge force. It has a lot of power, but one must control it. I can go now a little bit behind of the international welfare of animals in Australia. They say that the best whale conservation is whale watching, which means to educate people to know what is the nature. Mm-hmm. And the rock art has been used this method in Russia, especially to stop the hunting of the whales especially the white whale. Russians are still allowed to hunting all the gray whale in Kamchatka area as the traditional hunting of the local tribes. Mm-hmm. But for example, in the White Sea, there's no hunting anymore because during Soviet Union time, the Russians hunted white whale to the fodder of fox kolkhoz. They have a fox kolkhoz, and also they hunted in the Far East Kamchatkan area. And this is the way how gradually the population of the white whale was diminishing in the White Sea. But today it's something like 3,000 white whale during summer times. Mm-hmm. In the White Sea. And there's not anymore any discussion, should we start hunting or not? So it's now gone.
First off, I got to say that is a very smart and fascinating way to tackle a problem, because you can tell people all you want, oh, hunting is a problem and we need to stop these people from hunting. But just change the dialogue and say, let's show people whales and make that a more profitable industry, and they won't hunt whales anymore. And that's genius.
Yes, that's one must use the positive attitude and not negative to punish. One must keep it
right
to have a carrot, as we say, that let's do it this way, then don't that way. And sometimes when I've been in Russia, in I am doing the things I'm doing. I'm not criticizing nobody. And I just want that they start to mimic me. So it is, mm-hmm. I call it a mimical. So they try to compete that they, that what I'm doing. So that's the way, the best way to do.
You mentioned whaling in Japan briefly. And I know, I mean, whaling has been a staple of cultures all over, coastal cultures all over the world,
yeah,
at some point in time, even, of course, here in the United States and in other places. But prehistorically, and I know up in the Alaskan regions and the Yukon, obviously whaling is still a factor of lives up there. But in rock art that you've seen, an expression of whaling or whales in rock art, are there similarities or are there major differences in some of the areas that you've seen and how they look at the whales? Like, is it represented by hunting, or are they revered as creatures that provide, or is it, you know, a combination? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, in the old time, let's say 5,000, 6,000 years ago, the hunting or the white whale or any whale was mm-hmm. very difficult, extremely difficult. During the modern times, it was industrial whaling is completely different, because then the whale were like a mine. The industry mm-hmm. was mining the nature. And human being, let's say, the white man never has eaten even the whale flesh. We never eat it.
Right.
It was our oil well. We compressed the whale's body to the oil. For example, even in Norway, they are now still eating the whale meat. But they started to eat the whale meat 1944. Because usually before that time, the minke whale, which was still hunting in Norway, it was a fodder of fox farmer there. But in 1944, you know what happened. In 1994, there was hunger, and they tasted the meat of the whale, and they, because then they realized that it is not like a fox fodder, because human being was not eating the whale meat. It's the same thing is, I take you, Chris, to the local store, and I mm-hmm. buy a dog food to you, yeah. And I put it on the plate with the water or the milk, and I will say, come, Chris. The table is ready for you. So would you eat the same fodder as the dog, who is usually eating the rotten animals in the nature, like a wolf? No.
Right. Probably not.
No, probably not. So this is the thing, that the Norwegian eating the whale meat is so young tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Only the carcass of the whale was utilized in the area when the carcass was stranded. Okay, of course, like it was utilized like a tree which was flowing on the Gulf Stream to the lake, to the area of Iceland or the area of the Norway.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the thing I have been discovered in the literature.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting in reading about some of your work is how you're tying the rock art and the whales together. So it's not only kind of ecotourism around whale conservation and getting people to come whale watching, but then to tie it to these rock art sites where there are prehistoric images of whales, I thought was a really interesting way to enhance ecotourism and sort of make it this more powerful creation of both past and present, the importance of whales.
Yeah, actually, I created this project that way, that when the people are coming from Western country to north, to Karelia, to Russian area, first we went to the rock carving area where we can see the, let's say, the hunting images of the animals, and like moose and belugas. Because then the people mind are creating stories. Then we continue to the site of this island, which is called Solovetsky Island, Monastery Island in the White Sea, where the white whales are coming in the special cape every 11 hours. because it is the gathering site for making new babies and these kind of things. So the people, and there the whale watching is done by just standing on the coast, because they are coming maybe 20, 30 meters from you. So they are very near. There's no need to use the boat or whatever. And there's a nature trail made so that the people are walking 3 kilometers to this strand, and they spend something like 2-3 hours just watching the belugas who are coming there on that side. There are something like, let's say, 30, 40, sometimes 50 animals on this area. And White Valley is the matrilinear group, that each family is number of the animals is something like maybe 5, 6, 7. Mother and grandmother, the males are somewhere else, they are in the north, and youngsters are there. So this is the way that the people, the archaeology and nature is linked together. So this is the way how it works. And most fascinating thing is that, because I started this year was 2000, no, 1999. So nowadays, the majority of the people are Russians. Finally, they are there, because Russians are not nature people. The nature for Russian people is hunting and fishing. I mean the older people, let's say starting from 40, but younger people are more fascinating of the nature. So yeah. The teachers are coming by their classrooms, and then they are studying also other part of the nature, not only the animals but trees and whatever there is, and they spend something like whole day long, and the top is of course this. Is the studying the waves, because at the same time, usually summertime, 1.5 month, there is the Russian bioacoustic laboratory is making their scientific research on this site, because it is the most security site to study the waves, because they are always there, always, every 11th hour they come and spend this site, let's say 2-3 hours, and then they start to go somewhere else for fishing. So the scientists can make their acoustic studies, and actually they are studying the social behavior of the white whale. This is the hypothesis. So at the same time, the tourist can follow the scientist's work.
That's awesome. And I think that that intersection between scientists and tourism and getting that done is really what's going to save all the scientists, to be honest, you know, getting more people interested in that. And I'll tell you what, I've done whale watching in Oregon and California, here in the United States, and Hawaii, but I hope someday to do some whale watching up in that area, because I really want to go up to Finland and Russia and all this stuff. So, that would be fantastic. So we only have time for a couple more questions. So I want to make sure we talk about, because we mentioned the Lake Onega petroglyphs, and I want to have time to mention the new book. So you guys are publishing a new book based on these petroglyphs, and then another volume coming out later. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, this volume number 2 is now already printed, and it's available. And it's as heavy as a white, the blue whale, because it weighs almost 2.5 kilograms. And it, to my mind, I criticize the book, and the book is now, it puts new, let's say, demands on the research. And this book has utilized the most, the improved methods to describe the rock, to document the rock carvings. So that the volume number 3 is now under, let's say, in the beginning, because it took 20 years to make number 2. To make volume number 1, it took only 10 years. So there's still a lot of research to be done.
Yes. Okay.
Before they fade away, you see. They fade away. Wow. That is one reason to continue the work.
Speaking of fading away, I mean, one of the challenges with studying rock art is always both the natural elements sort of slowly degrading it over time, but also human concerns in the way we respect or don't respect it.
Yeah, that's the most difficult things that the human doesn't respect. They usually, sometimes they put a fire on the rock, and if you put a fire on the coastal rock, it will eat the surface of the rock, maybe usually 5 square meters. Wow. And we have seen this kind of the fire areas very often, and And in Russian, they are sometimes very difficult to work. But also in Finland, we have seen that hooligans has been around. Even the things are trying to be protected. But there's in Finland, there's not even any, I would say, any camera system to watching over the sites to have some kind of alarm that now should be something so could be done to go to the site, and, for example. Only I know that in Kola Peninsula there is now museum that during the summertime the museum workers are watching that the people are not touching the figures, and if something happens then they go by the small boat, fast post, and explain that it's not allowed. Even there are posters that that respect the site. So this is reality. This is reality.
Indeed. Well, we will end on that realistic note, and we'll have. We'll have some great links in the show notes, so check that out. And
all right.
Rauno, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for you.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.